Hey, Donna.
Yes, Chris?
Do you remember Adventures in Babysitting? Hello, and welcome to the first episode of Hey, Do You Remember? A show where we reminisce about a movie or TV show we grew up with, and then take off the rose-tinted glasses to see how it holds up today. I'm Chris.
And I'm Donna.
And today we're revisiting Adventures in Babysitting.
Meet Chris Parker. Getting ready for the greatest night of her life.
I gotta cancel.
Now she's stuck babysitting the Anderson kids. Sarah.
Mom got Chris to babysit for me.
Chris?
Her brother Brad.
Oh my.
His best friend Daryl.
Who is this kid?
Stray dog.
Take good care of my baby. I'll guard her with my life.
What could possibly go wrong?
Adventures in Babysitting is a 1987 film directed by Chris Columbus, written by David Simpkins, and starring Elizabeth Shue as Chris Parker, who reluctantly agrees to babysit the Anderson kids, winds up in the big bad city with them, and hijinks ensue. Donna, what do you remember about Adventures in Babysitting?
Well, Chris, I will tell you for sure that in 1987, when I was the ripe age of five, my parents were super strict about PG-13 movies, and I did not see this movie for at least another 5 years.
Yeah, same here.
However, I think I'm pretty sure I watched it with some friends at a slumber party, probably about 10 or 11 years old. Even then, I felt like it was pretty far-fetched, outlandish. I was already babysitting at the time. Like, I babysat, you know, a couple times a week, maybe, and you know, it was usually pretty fine. So, like, I thought it was going to be about, like, kids throwing stuff. I remember being like, what? Somebody pass the double stuff Oreos and let's talk about boys. Although it was, you know, I did find it entertaining, and it's still, I was under the age of 13, so I felt pretty, pretty excited about watching it. Let's see. I watched it again when I was probably about 15 because I realized that Anthony Rapp
was
in it, who I was just totally gaga over Rent at the time. So I was like, oh my God, I've got to see everything these people have ever done. And I watched it again and I was like, wow, huh.
It's a bit of an anomaly on his resume.
Yeah.
It definitely sticks out.
It definitely does. But, you know, hey, there you go. You got to start somewhere. That's, here you go, Adventures in Babysitting.
Yeah, I was also five when it came out. I don't think I saw it until I was 9 or 10. I don't know. I mean, I guess, like, first and foremost, what I remembered most about this movie was that Elizabeth Shue made my naughty bits tingle something fierce. I was a big fan of hers. And before rewatching it, the only plot point I could recall was the running joke about an issue of Playboy where one of the models looked like her. I couldn't tell you any of the characters' names, why they go into the city, what sort of shenanigans they get into, none of that. All I really remembered was the Playboy and Thor, the mechanic who looks like Thor, boobies and comic books.
Yeah.
That was my takeaway from Adventures in Babysitting. Surprise, surprise.
Perfect.
And it's not like they don't even show you the Playboy in any sort of great detail. I think even when the centerfold flips out at one point, you still can't see anything on it. But this movie came out, you know, when I was a little kid, and back then, just the word Playboy was enough to give you a boner. Not you. Girls don't have dicks, from what I understand.
No, I did not get boners from that, no. But I understand. Yeah, sure. It was happening for others.
Honestly, I wish there was more, because I'm sort of I'm embarrassed because I typically have a really good memory, especially about movies that I liked. And I do think I enjoyed this movie when I was little. I don't think I was even... I don't remember being, like, critical of it and it, like, oh, this would never happen. Like, I think I did enjoy it. And I remember renting it multiple times. It was one of those VHS covers where when you go into the video store, it just sort of calls to you. It had that great 80s style box art. I don't know if you remember this, but it's like they're scaling the side of the building, it was really stylized. Like,
absolutely.
Even the logo. And this is, I know this is going to sound weird. I don't know if it was meant to tie into the whole Thor thing that runs through it, because it's not like that's a huge part of the movie, but the comic book, it's comic book looking. Like, even when they show the title in the movie, it's got that weird, like, comic book sci-fi kind of look to it, which is, yeah, I don't know if that was intentional, but it seemed like a great way to get girls and boys interested in the movie, because I think a word like babysitting in the title might have been off-putting, you know, I don't know.
So audience, certainly, yeah.
Because, like, you know, the Babysitter's Club and all these things were kind of geared towards girls, but I just remember really loving that artwork. And for us, I think that's all we had. You would choose which movie to rent just based on the cover.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so the cool thing about going over our memories of these movies is to see how where we were at then or what was going on in our lives and how that may have influenced our opinions of it. But the other thing I think might be fun is to see if art imitates life or vice versa, and think about any moments we've experienced that maybe tie in to plot points or themes from the film we're looking at. So in this case, babysitting stories, either when we were the babysitters or the babysitties, when we were babysat, whatever. You said you were a babysitter. So if you have any stories related to babysitting.
Oh, yeah. So I started babysitting when I was probably about 10 years old for family down the street. And I remember one night in particular, when I was a little bit older, there were four kids. I was probably about 14 years old. And the kids were between like 11 and like basically like 6 months, you know, maybe a year old. And for, you know, whatever reason, they were kind of like ornery kids, but, you know, we got along well enough. And one night, I will never forget, they like strategically placed themselves around, they like surrounded me. They absolutely surrounded me and like attacked. Like, they were just throwing things, like, I don't know, they didn't want to go to bed or something like that, you know, and so they're absolutely like, I was under attack, Chris, like, kid you not. I mean, we got kids at two different, like, stairways throwing stuff at me, like plastic hard toys, and the baby's in my arms, like pulling my hair. One of them,
even the baby was in on it.
Oh yeah, the baby's like the ringleader almost, I feel like. And the other ones would come and like one would shoot out and like kick me, and I mean, it was awful. Like, that to me was my adventure in babysitting.
It's, you know what? That is like a key scene from, I can't believe I know this, from The Next Karate Kid, where Mr. Miyagi purposely sends her to a bunch of unruly children. That's like her karate training. It's why she wasn't as good as Daniel. Not quite as intense, her training program. But that was like the whole thing, where they had like a Nerf war and they were kicking her and attacking. I don't remember if there was a baby involved, but
that was traumatic. When I think about having children, I think about four kids strategically attacking me. it's you know, it's something to think about, you know. You gotta realize they are a strong population, those kids.
My babysitting story also involves an attack on a babysitter, but in a very different way. I had a few babysitting stories that came to mind, but there's one in particular that, even though it's the one I really don't want to share, I also know that means it's probably the one I have to share. I know you've heard this before, and it's a terrible story for our first episode, but
I'm so excited.
Here it is. So like the kid in the older brother in the movie, has a crush on Elizabeth Shue in the film. And I had a babysitter that I was in love with. Her name was Gina. She lived across the street from us. In retrospect, she was wildly inappropriate with my sister and I. Like, she was always talking about how much sex she was having, how she was having it, where she was having it, all the filthy, filthy, sexy details. And I was probably like 10 or 11 when this happened, like right on the cusp of being too old for a babysitter and feeling too old for a babysitter. And I mean, the point is, I was old enough that her stories, they really did a number on me. Like, I was in quite a tizzy. And so this one night, Gina's coming over to babysit Erica and I. Erica's my little sister. And I've decided this is the night, man. This is the night I lay it all out on the table and make my move. And the way I was going to do it was by tricking her into going out on a date inside my house. And I wanted to have this romantic dinner with low lighting, soft music, you know, really, really set the scene. and we did all that. Erica helped me out. She was like, she agreed to essentially be our waiter for the evening. But we were kids. We didn't know how to cook dinner. And like, I mean, I could pour a bowl of cereal. I knew how to toast a Pop-Tart, but that was like the high end of my culinary expertise. But we had a ton of candy left over from Halloween, so I just thought, like, yeah, that'll work. We'll just have some plates of little candy bars and Tootsie Rolls and Smarties. And it was awesome because Erica pretended she was French, because in all the movies where they go to a fancy restaurant, the waiter is French, and so her accent was shit. It was awful, but she was... I mean, she was 8 years old, so, you know, A for effort. And she committed. I mean, she kept the whole persona, like, the whole night. So Gina comes in and sort of immediately is like, the hell is going on here? We've got Michael Bolton or Celine Dion or some shit coming out of the CD player. The dining room's all made up. And so Erica leads her into the dining room, pulls out her chair, asks if she, you know, do you want anything to drink? And the main part of this plan is I'm hiding under the table. And I'm dressed up in my Sunday church clothes, my hair slicked back. This was my plan. She sits down, Erica takes her order, and then I pop up like, hey, it's sexy time. And but sort of as soon as she sits down, I realize I've fucked up in a pretty substantial way because I'm just staring straight at her humming a humming a meow meow. It rhymes with vagina. And it's like the exact scene from The Breakfast Club where Judd Nelson's under the desk. And I'm so confused because on the one hand, I feel like a scumbag and I know she's going to think I'm a scumbag. But I'm also like all hot and bothered by the view, like thinking, well, maybe this is better than a date. Maybe I'll just hang out here for a while. And so I'm frozen. I don't know what to do. And I know that the more time that passes, the worse it's going to be when I reveal myself. You know, like it's that much creepier. Yeah. Meanwhile, Erica is committed to this plan we've worked out. So now she gets her drink and she's taking her food order, which is basically French Erica saying, you're having candy, bitch, deal with it. And now Erica and I have agreed that once candy is on the table, that's when I get my cue to pop out. I'm already popping out under the table, but not in the way that her and I had discussed. And so now I'm really nervous. My stomach is just doing somersaults, and I'm sweating, and I feel sick. And it's insane how badly you can work yourself up. But, yeah, trouble was brewing. Because it's not just the hiding under the table and staring up her skirt that's uncomfortable now. It's the whole thing, the dress-up clothes, the slicked back hair, the music. It all feels so gross and wrong and like, this is Hannibal Lecter's origin story. This is how it starts. And so Erica comes in with the two plates and the whole thing is, it's supposed to be like, who's that second plate for? Ta-da! Pretend you don't notice my boner. And so I get my setup and I don't appear. And Erica prompts me again, and I still don't appear. And then I do the worst possible thing you could do in this situation. To say that I farted would be an unbelievably severe understatement. I fucking exploded. And I don't mean to get super gross, but I have to point out a few things. Number one, this is hands down the single loudest fart that's ever come out of me in my 31 years on this planet. And the echo from being under the table made it even worse. And it was like, it's like the day after you go to a rock concert and your head's still all like, ugh, and your ears are all messed up. So my hearing's shot. Number two, normally people are pretty tolerant of their own whatever. This made me sick. Like, stress farts are by far the worst. And this was like all the inner demons I'd held on to, like all coming out in this terrible cloud. It was like in Ghostbusters when they shut down the contamination unit and all the evil spirits start flooding out. Only it was my butt. And so number three, it hurt. Like, it burned really bad. And there's no reason anything this big should ever have come out of someone so small. And it startled me because it really snuck up on me. Like, no buildup, no countdown, just detonation. Cool. And then it concerned me. Like, hey, I might not be okay. Like, this is – maybe I should see a doctor. Thesis statement, it was bad. And so I'm thinking about this from Gina's point of view, because a lot of thoughts, they must start swirling around all at once. Like, okay, so something under the table just farted. I hope it was Chris, because if that was the dog, it's dead. And so now there's this realization that this little kid has been hiding under the table for at least 10 or 15 minutes, just staring at your nether regions. But the creepiness doesn't end there, because guess what? There's more, Gina. He's farting on you, too. And here comes my favorite part of the story. When I said Erica was committed to this scenario, Okay, so I blow out this offensively bad fart, and there's a moment of silence, and then I hear Erica say, "That was me." God bless my little sister trying to save me and salvage this date.
That is the best and we can.
Then I did the second worst thing you could do in this situation. I just ran. I crawled out from under the table. I ran up to my room and locked my door. That was not the last time Gina babysat for us, but things were like totally different after that. Like, we treated each other so differently. Like, there's just not a lot of conversation, very awkward, just terrible. And to this day, it's the only instance where one of my farts has had lasting ramifications. And that's my babysitting story. Let's get into it. Let's revisit Adventures in Babysitting.
Absolutely.
Starts off, and I immediately remembered why I was in love with Elizabeth Shue. Like, dancing in her little t-shirt and stockings, the big 80s hair, clearly too old for this movie. And this is how I know I'm too old for this movie now, is like, so she's dancing around, singing along to, I can hear the song, but I can't think of the name of it.
And Then He Kissed Me.
Okay, yeah, so she's singing along and dancing to this, and there's a part where she gets up on her bed, and she's using, like, the bedpost as a microphone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But to me, it just looks all, like, weird and phallic, and I'm like, clearly I've outgrown this film.
You were going to say that.
Okay.
30, and so I thought, well, I bet Chris is going to think that, and I just thought it, so, yeah. I know. I loved that opening scene so much, though. I did not remember it at all, and I just thought it was... she had me right away. It was magical. It felt really truthful. It felt like something. We do that all the time. Most of us are not lucky enough to have four-poster beds, but I imagine the ones that do use them as microphones.
Mm-hmm. And that she uses, like, the curtains on the window as a wedding veil.
Absolutely. The whole thing, yeah. Hairbrush, microphone, the whole, dancing around. Absolutely. That is actually, I never get ready for anything without dancing and lip syncing.
I might have to start. I didn't know this was a real thing.
It's a really wonderful day to start, or wonderful way to start any event, I really think. It gives quite a positive spin. Although the 90s was a lot of depressing music, so it's a different way to start. But I would recommend it, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Right, I'll give it a shot. And so, all of this is... all the singing and dancing is for her boyfriend, who pulls up in his IROC Camaro. And you know he's cool because the license plate says so cool.
So cool.
That's his vanity plate. So cool. I was already there when I saw the Camaro turning into the driveway. I was like, oh, this guy's cool. And then I saw the license plate, and I was like, I fucking knew it.
I thought the license plate made it way less cool.
Well, that's the thing, is advertising it equals probably not.
Boo! If I went to high school with him, I would have made fun of him. I don't care.
And also, we have to say, the boyfriend is played by Bradley Whitford, who from The West Wing and ton of other stuff. I love Bradley Whitford, but as the sexy boyfriend, the guy already looks like he's 30.
I was going to say, he looks like he's 35 when he comes to that
It's pretty creepy.
What are you doing with this old man?
His receding hairline and, what is going on? And his fucking name is Mike Todwell. That's, the perfect asshole boyfriend name.
Todwell.
And apparently this takes place before phones were invented, because he comes over to tell her, hey, I can't go out with you tonight. My little sister's sick. I'm really sorry.
I was thinking that too, rewatching it. Was like, wow, I can't believe he's
making the
he's
effort
to ditch this girl. I can't believe, even if his sister was really sick, I feel like a pickup of the phone would have been about enough. I mean,
it's because we really needed to see that Camaro. We really needed to establish. Would we know how cool he was?
That's
if he
true.
Just called.
He might have just been some guy, but now.
Right. Now we know.
So cool.
And then, so he says, sorry you went through all this effort getting ready and singing and jerking off bedposts, but I gotta break our date. And then, so she's complaining to her best friend, played by Penelope Ann Miller, who's Brenda, and Brenda becomes very important. She's sort of our inciting incident for all the misadventures that that wind up happening. Do you recognize this actress?
Crazy Brenda. No, I thought she looked familiar, but I did not.
She's been in a ton of stuff, and it's probably really demeaning to her to single out the credit that I'm about to. But she is the love interest in Kindergarten Cop. She's the mom that Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
But here she's actually, she actually does kind of look age appropriate for this movie. I think this must have been one of the first things she did, because she looks really young, and she's like the stock best friend character, big glasses, the high ponytail, or big stupid fucking earrings.
They really uglied her up. When I first saw her on screen, I was like, man, they take another gorgeous girl. You can tell she's gorgeous.
It's
disgusting glasses.
Okay, so they're commiserating about, fuck Mike Well, whatever his name
Todd
is. Mike Todwell, breaking their date or whatever. Chris's mom comes in and says, hey, since you've got the night free now, the Andersons are looking for a babysitter. And I guess we're meant to understand that this is the Andersons are trouble, because even Brenda is kind of like, oh, the Andersons. And Chris is like, oh, I don't want to do it. And but she does. Agrees to go babysit the Andersons. And then we meet the Andersons, and we get it's such a perfect, sitcom moment of Brad, the older brother, when he finds out Chris is going to be babysitting them, with the what? And he spills all the noodles on the floor.
He runs for his Clearasil.
The character's name is Brad, played by Keith Coogan, and I don't know if you recognized him, but he's also the brother in Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead.
Oh, one of my ultimate favorites.
The dishes are done, man. That's this guy. That's another movie we should do at
some
point.
What a dreamboat. We have to do that. Let's do it. Yeah.
I have to talk about the dress that their mom is wearing.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember this?
Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
It looks beautiful. Like gold wrapping paper. With some sort of leopard print on it. It's long sleeve. It's just her big dumb head is sticking out of the top of it. And it's the rest. It looks like a tacky mummy, or like she's going to a Klingon dinner party. I don't understand what the fuck is happening with this dress. I don't remember didn't hear anything that came out of her mouth, because I was just totally fixated on what she was wearing. Then we get, you know, the introduction to Sarah, the little sister. I fucking love Sarah. Sarah is probably my favorite character in this movie.
I do too. She's incredible. What a choice.
And she's like, I mean, she's legitimately a good actress too. Like, I think she's probably the best actor in this film.
Yeah, she's not bad at all.
Do you want to feel old? She's 35 now.
Oh, come on.
The actress's name is Maya Bruton. I don't know if that's how you pronounce her last name or that. She was also in, do you remember the TV show Parker Lewis Can't Lose?
It
was on Fox. It only lasted like one season. It was pretty great. And she was in that after this as well. I don't really know what else she's done since that. But yeah, I love Sarah. I love, like, we see her in her room and she's got the Thor posters all over the place. Oh. I dug the My Pet Monster doll in the background. I'd forgotten all about those things.
Yeah.
I love that the Thor drawing she's scribbling on when Brad comes in to bother her is like, it looks like it's been drawn by a professional. Like they got a comic book artist to, like the actual artist from Thor. And meanwhile, it's this like 10-year-old girl.
Mm-hmm.
So then, all right, as this introduction to the family plays out, what I'm thinking to myself is, I do not remember hating Brad this much when I was a kid. Like I probably identified with him. I was waiting for the scene where he hides under a table and farts on her. But now I'm thinking he's just like, oh, this guy's too old for a babysitter. And like, and then I know later the mom says, oh, he's going over to his friend's house. You don't have to worry about him. But Brad creeps me out. I don't like Brad.
Oh.
And you didn't have a problem with him?
Oh, what a good guy. He's just embarrassed, and he's like, he likes her so much, you know, and he's, I thought he was all right. I didn't have a problem with Brad.
I know I didn't when I was little. I don't know. I guess this is irrational. You know what it is? It's like, look, I love Elizabeth Shue. He loves Elizabeth Shue. There can be only one.
Yeah, he gets to hang out with her, and you don't.
I know.
I'm so sorry, dude.
And we mentioned earlier that Anthony Rapp is in the movie. He is Daryl, Brad's best friend. I think you mentioned he was in Rent. That's sort of what he's best known for. He was also in Dazed and Confused. Actually, the movie version of Rent was directed by Chris Columbus as well, same guy that directed this movie.
Oh, there you go.
I love Daryl's introduction with him blowing on the sliding glass door. It's so random.
Perfect kids. Hey, before you get too much further away from
Sarah.
I have to say, I did not remember Sarah much at all, but as an adult, female, looking at that, I seriously like got up and jumped for joy. Not seriously, but I could have, because I think now I see so many little girls, everybody's a princess, and that's great, and princesses are cool and stuff, but to have a little girl role model that doesn't wear pink and that likes Thor, for heaven's sakes. Like,
right, not even an A-list superhero.
So cool. No, yeah, it's not even like Batman, Superman. She likes Thor, which I think is the coolest thing in the world. She is strong and she is determined. She's so... she really, I mean, yeah, like any kid is going to have big beliefs and believe stuff that, you know, isn't really true, but to pick Thor for that, for me, was so incredible, and I was so thrilled and so happy as an adult that I would have seen that as a child, to see another child having a role model like that.
Right.
Instead of, like, you know, Barbie, who I loved. I loved Barbie. I had a ton of Barbies, no Thors. But I thought that was incredible, and I want more little girls like that in movies where they like things that aren't necessarily feminine, but they're still little girls. They're still cool little girls.
Right.
I loved that. I thought that was amazing, seeing that as an adult. It was, like, my favorite part of the movie, I think.
Yeah, you're right. Like, the princess thing would have been, like, the obvious direction to go with that character. And like I said at the beginning, that was one of the only things I remembered about the movie was this Thor obsession. And so, yeah, she was also my favorite part of the movie.
So cool.
So we meet Daryl, and then I think it's like, oh, Brenda's in trouble. That's when they get the phone call. Yeah. And she settles in for the normal night of babysitting, and then Brenda calls, and it's like, Chris, help, I'm in a bus station, I ran away from home. So she's in the city. She's in Chicago. And this is where we're first introduced to the big city equals danger. It's like another world. It's so scary. And that's the whole conceit of Adventures in Babysitting. It's like, because at the bus station, it's like you get the angry homeless guy and the fucking guy who flashes his gun at her with a grin on his face.
Yeah, he just shows. Oh, it's ridiculous.
This is someone who's never been to the city's version of the city. It's like a story my grandma would tell me when I was little. I had this alarmist grandmother who would be like, oh, the killer bees are coming from Africa and stay out of the city. It's full of bald Chinese ladies with no pants and perverts with guns. It's so cartoonish and
it's crazy
and ridiculous, and I want to talk more about that later. I have more to say about how this movie kind of flirts between like the reality of being on the south side of Chicago and then some of the more like screwball comedy elements of it, and how successfully it kind of balances between those two things. The south side is a little like a legitimately dangerous place.
The world is a legitimately dangerous place.
I think, suburban kids traveling into Chicago, I mean, the South Side is, if you've never been to the city, that kind of is like, that's not really where you want to start.
It's probably not. No, you're probably right about that. You're going to want to go loopish. You want to spend money in the loop would be my...
Mag Mile.
Yeah.
Millennium Park.
How they end up... They're a little silly.
I'm thinking if the story really is from the point of view of these kids, I mean, did we think of the city as this strange mythic place when we were little? Because I think I maybe probably did.
Were you at all afraid of the city when you were a kid? Like, did you think bad things would happen there? Or?
I don't know. My grandma, again, bringing my grandma into this. You know, she'd always have the news on when we were over, and every news story is all about, every murder, every crime is all in the city. I don't know. I really don't remember what my sense of the city was, other than it. I'm sure I must have romanticized it to some degree, and I'm sure I must have been intimidated by it too to some degree.
Well, I was a little bit further away than you growing up from Illinois, but always lived a few hours away from Chicago. So I remember very vividly, we would go, we would come up to Chicago maybe once a year, go to museums or go see a show. We'd always go to Michigan Avenue. So by the time I saw this movie, I'm sure I'd been to Chicago probably 5 to 10 times, and I loved it. I thought it was very romanticized. I loved going to the city. There was an element that I knew that it was different, that I knew there were more people, which made it more dangerous. I could get lost easily. When I realized, which I didn't until I rewatched it just recently, that it was set in Chicago or in Oak Park. I didn't realize that, and it sort of infuriated me when they started thinking that. I was like, are you kidding me? It's terrible. This is why Chicago did not want people making movies here, because you just terrify everyone coming here. That's ridiculous.
I'd forgotten it took place in Chicago, too, and the reveal, I was kind of like, oh, get fucked. And like, but I think it's so different from us now having lived here so long that like, and knowing the city like we do, and then to people outside of it. Well, and what you just said actually reminds me, it's like, I don't want to paint the picture that, as they travel into the city, they're all like terrified of it. I mean, the whole thing is basically Brenda talks Chris into coming to get her, and she's trying to get the kids to stay behind, and they're like, oh, you're going into the city? Well, we're coming too. We want to see the city. Yeah. So it is like this exciting mythical thing to them. They're not afraid to go. They should be. They don't know it. But when they come out to the car though, so like, Chris and I think I've called him Chris a couple times. See, this is how closely I identify with this character. Please fart on your babysitter. When Brad and Sarah convince Chris. That's what's throwing me. The babysitter's name is Chris.
Yeah.
To let, you know, to tag along to go get Brenda from this bus station. So they're walking out to the car, and Daryl pops out behind them, like, where are you going? But he's in the damn bushes. What is he doing in there? Why is he hiding in the bushes? He doesn't know they're coming outside. How long was he going to stay there? I want to...
Listen, dude.
But so Daryl worms his way in, too, and so they all pile into this station wagon, the classic 1980s movie station wagon that everyone in the suburbs owned, and they're driving into the city, and as they get to Chicago, Sarah says something about, like, that's where Thor lives.
Oh, yeah.
When she's looking at the city, because all superheroes live in cities. And I'm like, Thor does not live in Chicago. I'm pretty sure he doesn't even spend that much time on Earth. Like, this movie really counts on the fact that most people probably had no idea who Thor was. Like, they're just going to invent all kinds of... And there's, like, a speech later on she gives to the mechanic about, like, Thor always does this and that, and he always says blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I think you're talking about Superman. Like, all superheroes were just, like, totally interchangeable.
General Logan. The mechanic, who is Vincent D'Onofrio.
Oh, we're going to get to that. Believe me. Believe me.
He killed me.
Oh, and this is where we're introduced to, in the back seat, is like Daryl's got a copy of that Playboy that I was talking about, where he's like, oh, you got to see, or maybe it comes in earlier. Maybe he says something about it when he first comes to the door. Either way, the Playboy comes out in the back seat, and he's trying to show Brad, look, this chick looks like Chris. Mm-hmm. And the Playboy cover, because this is a PG-13 movie for kids, it looks like a senior portrait. There's nothing like sexual or like alluring about it. It's just like this glamour shot.
She's
horrible.
Lying down. I think she's lying down. That's
on the actual cover, though. Like, isn't the cover just her face?
I think so, but I think that happens, right, in Playboy.
I think now it's even though they're not like, you know, flashing their yoo-hoos, I think they're still like they try to be suggestive. I don't know why I'm harping on it. Listen, I wanted nudity, Donna. Where are the boobs is what I was saying throughout this whole film.
It did not register.
And that's okay. So they're on their way. They're almost into the city. And then, of course, they get a flat tire. And the only reason I'm bringing up the flat tire thing is that this is a bizarre moment where Chris is understandably freaking out like you would in this situation. I have a flat tire. I'm in the middle of a highway. Where do I pull off? How do I, you know, what do we do here? What do we do in this situation? Everyone else in the car is laughing like a maniac. And then the car pulls over. They all get out. They're looking at it. And they're laughing. So Daryl's laughing so hard. He's like going to pass out. And I'm thinking like, hey, maniacs, you're like triple thunderfucked. What are you doing? What is so funny? You're all in a lot of trouble.
They have no idea. That's like when the kids attacked me babysitting. They were having a great time. They thought it was hilarious. They don't have any sense of reality of what, because their whole lives are protected. Like, nothing that bad has happened to them. So they think like, oh, well, I'm sure some way we'll get out of this. This is your problem, and I know you'll figure it out. Like,
the laughing is so insane, and it goes on for so, like, it's not just like, haha, we got a flat. It's like, holy fucking shit. I'm like, this kid's barometer for what's funny is like, it needs to be recalibrated. Like, you can't, like, if this is, I've gone on way too long about the flat tire, but thanks to the flat tire, the mechanic, the tow truck shows up, and this is our first cartoonishly stupid big city character.
Oh my God.
It's the mechanic with the hook for the hand.
You kids must be from the suburbs, huh?
I wrote that down. I wrote that line down. Like, yeah, because in the city, we all have hooks for hands. What are you staring at? It's like, that's how he knows. You must be from the suburbs, staring at my fucking hook for a hand. I'm an urban legend, but please don't stare.
I have never met anyone in my time in Chicago with a hook for a hand.
And no.
If I did, I would welcome them. But that, I'm telling you, that is...
Well, and I feel like he's one of these guys that's like... He's like throwing it right in their face. He wants them to see.
Oh, he does, yeah. So
it's like the girls with, like, the low-cut shirts that are like, my eyes are up here. It's that sort of situation where it's like, look at this fucking hook. What are you looking at? Mm-hmm. But you know what? Okay, so I'm like, well, what is going on with this dude? But then what I thought was nice is they get in his truck and he's driving them back to the garage. And he turns out kind of to be like a big teddy bear of a guy. He's like a really, really nice guy. So and I'm thinking like, oh, this is good. The movie's teaching kids like this nice lesson about judging people based on their appearances. And then 10 seconds later, it's, oh, nope, never mind. He's a psychopath. He's going to go murder his wife and her boyfriend. Like, he gets the call, comes over the radio. She's with him again. And makes a detour.
Rage.
He drives into the lawn. He starts shooting at his wife. You don't see what's going on in the house. You just hear a bunch of screaming and stuff breaking, which is even kind of more horrific. And then the gun going off, and you don't know what's going on in there. And then, unless I missed something, I believe Chris's solution to this is to carjack the whatever the car is on parked outside the house.
Cadillac, yeah. I think she's just like, oh, let's get in another car.
Right, but I mean, they're straight up stealing someone's car. Are they not, or are they just hiding in there?
I think they are. I think she thinks they're in super present danger, and
so we're just going to be carjackers.
Yeah, I think you're in. What are you in the suburbs? Does everyone leave their keys in their ignition? Like, how is she going to? She's not going to hotwire that car.
Well, she's in luck because a real carjacker shows up.
Awesome.
And has no qualms about taking off in a car with, there's nothing about like, hey, you might want to get out. He sees them all in there and he's like, oh, what's up? Gets in the driver's seat. And there's a moment, it's just a couple of seconds of screen time, but there's this wide shot as the carjacker pulls away with them in the back seat and everything. And the hook for hand mechanic is punching out the boyfriend in the front lawn. And for a few seconds, this is the best film adaptation of Grand Theft Auto we're ever going to see. Like, seriously, this looks just like a moment from the games. This one shot. I was like, holy shit, I've played this part.
I love it. Well, the carjacker was already in the car. He was like in the process of stealing it, and they just got in. And he was like, well, I'm stealing this car right now, so I guess you guys are coming with me. Like,
okay, all right, you're right, and that's, I'd forgotten that, and that's a little better, but also maybe P.S., get out of the car.
I would, if I was jacking a car and a bunch of kids got in, I'd be like, hey, get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, try the next one.
Car's taken. Get out. Yeah, would be my first. But I'm not a carjacker, so I don't really know. I can't really put myself.
Yeah, I don't know what the protocol is. Maybe this is like, there's like an employee manual. Like, if in this scenario, blah blah blah. But this is a very mellow, very nice car thief. Like the tow truck driver. Also very nice to them. Very understanding of their plight. And he says like, oh, hey man, I'll be your taxi driver. I'll take you to where you need to go. Let me just stop off somewhere and take care of some business really quick. So then we get to the chop shop sequence where the car thief delivers, you know, he brings the car in and we see them stripping other cars, and there's some very unsavory characters sitting around a table planning all kinds of nefarious shit. The bad guy, this is the first time we're introduced to the dude that's going to be like the main villain of the movie. This dude, I don't know about you, but I found this guy genuinely unnerving. He's got that sunken face and that voice and that way of, I'm not doing the worst impression of this guy ever.
Yeah, it's just like, it doesn't sound like that, no. But yeah, I know what you mean.
The guy's name, I looked him up. The actor's name is John Davis Chandler. I remember him from Phantasm 3, but he's been in like tons of movies. The Outlaw, Josie Wales. His voice, you know what? Since I can't do the impression, there were moments where I thought it might be the same guy that did the voice of the doctor from The Nightmare Before Christmas, the one that built Sally.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They have a very, very similar voice. But so what I love about this dude, though, and the reason I like that he's kind of really creepy, is that I feel like the movies that we grew up with were less afraid of putting kids in real danger.
Yes.
And giving them like a real threat. Like now with a lot of the kids movies, what you see is like villain, there's bad guys, but they're kind of dopey or stupid or silly, and like they're not legitimately terrifying.
Yeah, they're not good at being bad guys. They like want to destroy the world, but they can't quite get it together.
I know that's a huge generalization, but I do think we saw more of this sort of thing in the 80s and maybe even into like the early 90s and stuff, where, you know, you think about stuff like The Goonies or those types of movies, where they were legitimate threats. They were real bad guys.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
I liked this sequence with them getting locked in the office and then escaping through the roof.
Oh.
And then, like, the balancing on the rafters, and they kick the dust off the rafters into that guy's coffee, and, like, I just thought that scene actually did a pretty good job of, like, building suspense and it's like the first time you kind of get the sense that like, oh man, they are in like way over their head.
Oh my God. I hated that scene, because how ridiculous are you going to be as a babysitter? Like that is seriously, I mean, they are like 40 feet above the ground and you're just going to have three kids walk across this plank. I was completely, completely out of it. I was like, this is ridiculous. There's no possible way you would even do this on your own, maybe if you were like a full-time balance beam walker. But you're taking three children.
Well, okay, but isn't the understanding that they're going to be dealt with, in quotes, after this meeting wraps up, which presumably means we're going to kill them?
I mean, that is just, again, I just think, like, you stupid fucking kids. Like, calm down. They are not going to kill you, for heaven's sakes. I mean, really, you think, like, I couldn't...
Well, even if... Okay, so I'm going with the movie at this point. I understand it's ridiculous. If this were real, if, like, obviously murder is not the go-to solution. I didn't have a problem with that. Like I said, I'm just going with the movie at this point. But the other thing is maybe it's less about whether or not we believe they're going to get killed and more about do they believe they're going to get killed.
I guess.
If they stay in that room.
I guess.
I like the 80s-ness of it. I like that, like, oh, and they're in the rafters. And I like that the car thief looks up and sees him at one point in that reaction shot and just like, what? Like, I love that. And I like kicking the dust in the coffee and the guy immediately picking it up and drinking it. And I was, were you not waiting for the reaction of, oh, it's pretty good?
When he drank it,
that's good. The dirt made it better. Like, I was totally waiting. That was the only thing that could have made it even more 80s than it already was. I thought this did a really nice job of, like we mentioned earlier about, like, between the tightrope between reality and full-on fantasy, like, kind of turning, you know, more of a cartoon comic book sort of thing. It's ridiculous how long we've talked about this moment.
Okay.
Okay, so they, because it's ridiculous, they do escape. This plan works. She's the worst babysitter alive and gets rewarded for it continuously. So they make it out alive, and the bad guys do realize, like, hey, it's kind of like in the nick of time. They're out the window, and then the bad guys are like, let's go up and, you know, go check on them in this office. Or they need the Playboy, right? That's what it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Daryl, at one point, Brad throws Daryl's Playboy out the window of the station wagon. Is that right?
Yes.
And it's his dad's. Right.
In trouble.
So he sees the same issue on the desk in the office of the chop shop. And so he swipes it, you know, realizing I can just put this one in its place. And this is the part I remembered. One of the only scenes I remembered from the movie was when they're walking across those beams, the Playboy slips out and the centerfold unfolds and she's not naked. I know I'm going back to this again. More nudity! But there is, I mean, it's, even when I was like, however, eight or nine when I saw this movie, even then I was like, oh, come on. Playboy's have, that's what Playboys are. Am I wrong? Like, they're supposed to be naked women.
You're right.
It's a PG-13 movie. It's for kids, obviously. They can't. Yeah. They can't show that stuff. But anyway, so they escape. Someone at the we're at the meeting with these bad guys, and one of them is like, "Well, what'd you do with the Playboy?" Well, it's I took it up to the office because I was masturbating. That is basically what that guy says, right?
He does, yeah. He pretty much says that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I took it upstairs to.
I was reading one of the articles.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, jeez. I think it's saying, you know, yes.
So I guess, yeah, there's notes for, like, some transaction or something. Something's been written down inside this Playboy. So they go upstairs, obviously realize, hey, it's gone, and so are all those kids. So they go chasing after them. And
like 5 feet behind them. They're, like, right there.
Right. And so they have to duck into the first place they can get into, which is a blues club. And because – and not just a blues club. I mean, it's like because this is an 80s movie, the door goes right to the stage.
Yeah.
And they're on stage. They are through the door on the stage.
I loved it. That's when the movie had me for sure after the door
This scene is fucking great.
It's good. It's a really good scene.
It starts with like the stone-faced crowd who gradually they kind of start bobbing their heads like, all right. And then by the end, they're like full on into it, and like yeah, everybody loves them. So the guy on stage playing is the late great Albert Collins, and he stops his set and he looks at them, and Chris sort of says like, I'm a babysitter, I'm trying to get these kids out of here, and he says nobody leaves without singing the blues. As this started, I kind of groaned because I hated this part as a kid. I thought it killed the momentum. I remember I had forgotten it, you know, when I was thinking about the movie beforehand. But once it started, I was like, oh, this part. But, I mean, like I said, I kind of really like it now. It's so silly, and they're way too good at improvising the lyrics and the backup vocals and the dance moves. But it made me laugh. And what I really like about it is the undercurrent of this scene, the whole tone of it. They're singing this song about this misadventure they're on, and it all comes back to this idea that, hey, Brenda's probably dead, but aren't we a hoot? aren't we just adorable, singing and dancing up here? Our friend's dead.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty outstanding. I loved it, too. Watching it was like that. Was the first part that felt like it might have been a real Chicago place.
Yes.
Me, that was like, oh, yeah, of course, there's a blues club, and these guys are playing awesome blues.
Yeah.
And, you know, all these crazy kids end up on stage. But,
right, this is not just generic chop shop, big city locate. Like, this is very, this scene does feel very, very Chicago.
It does. So I liked it. I thought it was good.
I like how it, you know, at the end, they start marching out like in a conga line to the exit, like as if everybody in the club is aware that there are some mobsters chasing them and like, we'll get you out of here. Yeah. It's just so bizarre. Like, no song has ever ended this way.
No.
Ever.
No.
And they've got the magical guitars that keep playing even though they're like, you know, 20 feet from the stage. And yeah.
Their hands above their heads and the guitar's still going. Yeah.
And so that's how they escape, and then the mobsters get stuck there because Albert Collins tells them too, oh, you can't leave until you sing the blues.
I was watching it again. I'm like, seriously, does everyone who goes in there have to sing?
Yeah.
I mean, because it's a room full of people, and I'm thinking like,
has everybody sung?
Are you playing like 70 extra songs for like each of these people? I don't know. Maybe you get it down. I've never been to a place like that. I keep waiting for someone to ask me to get up on stage and sing the blues. It has not happened.
What I've learned is their song is so fucking good and almost it seems so rehearsed. Like, I feel like I've got to have lyrics ready for when this happens to me, if this happens to me.
You bet you do. I can't believe you don't already.
Is the next scene the scene on the L train?
Yes.
Holy shit, balls covered in more shit. This scene is bananas.
It's like the Warriors come.
That's what I wrote. Two gangs from the Warriors show up. And this for me, oh my God. This for me is the second biggest what the fuck moment in the movie. Number one is coming up like almost right after this. But okay, so these two street gangs come in on opposite sides of the train car. Oh, and they're about to have this gang war is about to erupt, right, and Chris and the kids are in the middle of it. She stands up right before they're going to attack each other to be like, hold on, can you just wait till we get off at the next stop? And there's like some back and forth between the two of them. And this is the exact line that one of the gang leaders says to her. Don't fuck with the lords of hell. I was like, this is a little intense for a kid's movie.
Oh my God. It is a little intense for a kid's movie. These guys are wearing like the most cartoonish gang outfits I could even imagine. And lords of hell is a little bit just too much, but it's so ridiculous.
It's just the whole line comes out of left field. I mean, and then she follows it up with probably the most famous line in the movie, which is don't fuck with the babysitter.
It's true. Yeah.
And I remembered the second part. I cannot believe I don't remember that first line. That is magnificent. I remember don't fuck with the babysitter, but I couldn't remember where in the movie it was and what context it was said and all that. When I remembered that line, for like half a second, I was like, oh, that was the tagline of the movie. And I was immediately like, no. Oh, that would be impossible on a poster.
Definitely.
If anyone is listening to this and is inspired, there is nothing I would love more than for people to Photoshop inappropriate taglines onto the Adventures in Babysitting poster and send them to us.
Do it, absolutely.
And if anybody actually does, I'll post all of them up on the site. That would make my day.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is like we go right from, you know, the blues club scene is also a little over. It's a little ridiculous, but again, it's like we said, it felt a little more authentically Chicago, and the movie was just kind of starting to, you know, really win me over, and then this happens.
Oh, it's just,
and we're back to alarmist grandma's version of Chicago.
Oh my God! Yeah, it's pretty.
You're gonna wind up on a train with the fucking demon dicks from fucking hell, whatever the name is. What is it?
The Lords remember. Of Hell.
Yeah, those guys. I actually gasped. I'm embarrassed. I gasped when he threw the knife into Brad's foot. I was like, oh, Brad.
Oh,
Brad's
no.
Foot.
I was like, I went through his toes. He's all right.
That's what I thought too. But then you see them carrying him to the hospital. It's like it's in his foot. Mm. And I was like, right on, movie. That's I was not like that. I didn't say that.
It is impressive, though, that they actually... I was amazed that the movie actually allowed him...
To get hurt, yeah.
Get hurt like that. That's, again, in movies today.
I mean, Donna, the drug lords from Satan's Asshole, I can't... I'm sorry, I cannot remember the name.
Lords of Hell.
Those guys.
Drug lords from Satan's Asshole. That was the
I mean,
game.
Those guys mean business. If he's going to... throw a knife at a kid's foot, you better believe it's going to hit his foot. Well, here's the thing, though. It's like, so you get this amazing, bonkers line of, you know, don't fuck with us. And I'm like, man, this is a kid's movie. And then in, like, the next scene, you've got that scene with Brenda and the hot dog vendor where he's talking about, like, I'm going to, you know, I'll slip you the wiener. I have the wiener. This is, I mean, just back to back of like, fuck this, fuck that, wieners. It's like, what is happening? Who is this movie for? Okay, and then we get into, this is where the movie, like, it nosedives for me for one really specific reason. Because I think after the hospital scene, did you want to say anything about the hospital scene?
No, I thought it was pretty boring.
Brad goes in, he gets stitched up. They think he's dead for half a second because it's the doctor from Arrested Development with his bad news. And then, but then he's not, and everybody's happy to see him, and they're on their way. And so they wind up at this frat party.
Frat party? A frat party.
band that is way too old to be playing a frat party.
Yeah.
So I didn't look up. I forgot to look up and see if that was like an actual 80s band. It must be. It must be somebody. It can't just be a group of extras they threw together to be like, you're a rock band. Because they could have then come up with something. I mean, these guys look like a bunch of dads that get together on the weekend.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, yeah, the frat party setting in general kind of bummed me out. Like, really? This is kind of, we have to like escalate things. We can't like go from chop shop, gang war, frat party.
Yeah. It was a little.
And also.
Let's go there. Yeah, fine. Sure. There's a frat party. We'll just go there. They just sort of like.
Yeah, they kind of. I was going to ask you if I'd missed something about why. Is it just like around the corner from the hospital? Do they just walk up into this party?
I mean, that's how they get everywhere. They just walk from the south side to the loop in like a half a minute.
That's how the city works.
Yeah, it's how it is. I can absolutely attest to that. But they.
How many gang wars have you been caught in the middle of on the L? Countless.
Gotta be up to 70. I don't know. It keeps happening.
But we know not to fuck with them.
I don't fuck with them. That's the simplest answer. Just don't fuck with them. It's fine. But, I think what happens is Daryl is excited because he likes frat parties. Going to this party! And they just have to go with him. So they do.
All right, I'm going to talk about Daryl's big scene at the frat party in a second because it's pretty epic. But the main thing that happens here is we get introduced to, like, the dreamy college guy.
Andrew McCarthy.
It's not Andrew McCarthy.
It is. I think it is.
No, his name. It's.
Yeah, he's the guy from Pretty in Pink.
It's an actor named George Newbern. He was. Do you remember the Steve Martin Father of the Bride movies?
Yeah.
He's the husband in those.
Well, to me, his name is Schmandrew McFlarfy. And that, they just couldn't afford Andrew McCarthy.
That's what happened. Andrew is busy. Get Schmandrew on the phone.
Schmandrew.
Well, the thing that bothers me about Schmandrew is that he's supposed to be like the dreamy new love interest, but he's kind of dweeby, like in his plaid blazer and his mullet and. I mean, even in the 80s, wasn't his outfit a bit like...
Now, I'm going to say, I mean, I appreciate your fashion awareness. I did not notice that. I was immediately had like the wanted girl reaction. It was like, oh, wow, he's so dreamy. Oh, it's so nice.
You serious? You think he's this guy's an acceptable love interest?
I do. Yeah.
Well, you did when you thought it was Andrew McCarthy. Now that you know it's not.
Andrew, get this joker out of here.
Does it still work? I don't know, man. The reveal of him, and because you know immediately as soon as he turns around, you know, like, I know. Okay, so here's his role in the film. I know how this is all going to play out. I was just kind of like, I don't know, man. This girl has terrible taste in men.
I mean, she does. It's getting slightly better, I think, maybe.
He is. I mean, he's an improvement over Fuck Stickwell or whatever. Mike Todwell. What is my problem? I'm sorry. But is this guy cool? We don't know. Where's his license plate? I'd like to know a few things first.
I see no documentation.
I need some verification. Like his license plate, does it say "nice guy" in all caps? I don't know. I think we should. I mean, what if it's like, what if his car is, you know, date rapist? Get away, Chris. We don't know. We know nothing about him until we see his license plate. But speaking of the frat party and Daryl's big scene, this to me is the biggest what the fuck moment of the movie. This is number one. I don't know if. I don't know if you thought this was strange, but so what happens is all these college guys are slamming beers and little Daryl's there, big grin on his face, trying to sit in and hang with these college guys. And so he laughs a little too hard at one of their jokes. And the one guy, they all go quiet and stare at him. And the one guy says, "I must be hallucinating. Anyone else see a talking penis?" First of all, second of all, Daryl's reply, okay, and this I wrote down. This is it, word for word. Speaking of penises, do you know how the Playboy Unabashed Dictionary defines oral gratification? then this fucking slut leans in like, I do. But I'm like, no, wait. I want to know where he was going with that. That strikes me as the most ludicrous reply.
The whole interaction between college kids and actual kid is a little bit crazy. I feel like you really notice when a super underage person shows up
drinking popcorn instead of beer.
Yeah. I don't know. I think I would have expected them to be like, what the fuck is this kid doing here?
They didn't.
Like, it was all this, yeah, it was this weird Playboy. And
for me, more lines need to start with, speaking of penises.
Yeah. You know what? I admire Daryl's tenacity. He's not a quitter. He's not going to let some guy, he's got these little retorts and he's just ready with them. Maybe
did you notice about Daryl that I feel like they were setting up like he was supposed to have a catchphrase?
Yeah, it seems like they might have tried a few times to make a catchphrase for him.
One that stuck out to me was, you think? Because he keeps saying it at moments where you wouldn't say that. And then Sarah says it to him at one point, like she's throwing it back in his face.
See, I didn't even notice that because it's something that people say. Like, that's not.
I feel like they were trying to make you think happen. Like, that was supposed to be his thing.
Fail.
But speaking of penises, the next scene is Vincent D'Onofrio as Dawson the mechanic.
Oh, yes.
What's crazy is that this is the same year that Full Metal Jacket came out.
Is that right?
Oh, and can you think of two characters, like, further apart?
Nutty.
I mean, in the same year.
That's crazy. I can't believe
it. I believe, like, Full Metal Jacket probably, I think they filmed that movie for a long, 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 long time. And I'm sure Adventures in Babysitting was made in between when that film wrapped production and when it was actually released. But still, I mean, this dude is, like, to this day, he's still probably one of my favorite actors. Like, this is a man I think can do almost anything. But I totally forgot he was the mechanic.
Oh my god, I forget so much that he does, and that's, I think he's an amazing actor too. And a lot of it is because I frequently do not recognize him, even though I think physically you can sort of tell. But I think he really puts on that character to such an intense level. That I really, he's like halfway through a Gary Oldman movie, I'm like, wait, that's Gary Oldman? And I see the credits and I'm like, wait, Vincent D'Onofrio was in that?
That's, I think, because I was looking for him, that like as soon as he's on screen, I'm like, ah, there he is. That's right. He's in this movie.
I was looking for him too. And honestly, I did not recognize him. Maybe it was the blonde hair. I was just so thrown by or overwhelmed.
Did you want him to put the helmet on?
I did.
I did too. I was a little let down when the scene ended and I was like, oh, he's just going to hold it?
Yeah.
I want to see Vincent D'Onofrio's Thor.
Let me just say this to you, because Schmandrew takes the kids back to this to get the car.
Yeah.
And he says, okay, well, let me come inside with you and make sure everything's going to be okay. And she's like, no. Everything's fine. It's going to be fine. And I have to be like, what in the world? Why would anything be fine? Why would you ever assume through the night's events that you could just go in there $5 short and it would just be fine? Like, that to me is the craziest decision she's ever made.
Okay. It's ridiculous. I agree. Here's why I'm okay with it, is because if he had come in with them, then we're stuck with him for the rest of, like, the film through the climax and all the crap that happens there. And I want Schmandrew out of the movie. The less of him, the better. So if that means a ridiculous scene with, like, I'm sure I won't get murder raped, see you later, then fine. So be it. Get it. Go home, Schmandrew.
All right.
I think then the next part is they're on, oh, they pass the restaurant that So Cool is supposed to take her to, and they see
there for their anniversary.
They see his Camaro parked out or parked there. They know it's his because of the aforementioned license plate.
Certainly.
And so they stop in to see what's up, and surprise, surprise, Fuck Dickwell is there with another girl.
A slut. Not just another girl. She's a
She does slut. Stuff with so many guys' dicks. Mm. And then so there's this awesome confrontation where... is it awesome? What am I saying? It's not. Where what Daryl kicks him in the behind.
Yeah.
And then he lands on a table and just stays there. He just lays there while they walk out.
Oh, perfect. Perfect.
Okay, so that all happens, blah, 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 blah. You think the movie is winding down, but wait, there's more. Oh. Because Sarah has run away, right? Because she's seen a toy, they've passed a toy store. She goes to check out the toy store, and then the mobsters have caught up with them because Car Thief knows the garage they're picking their station wagon up from, and so they start chasing Sarah. And something we haven't talked about yet is that the Andersons' parents are at a Christmas party? Is it a Christmas party or is it just a party? I don't know. Who cares? There's some big to-do at one of the buildings downtown. It's the Crane Communications Building, which if you don't live in Chicago, I think you would even still recognize it. It's this iconic sloped diamond-shaped roof building. And they keep seeing it throughout the film. And no matter where they are in the city... they're always looking at the front of it. Did you notice that?
I did, yeah. Yeah, it's always the front.
And it's always terribly, like, composited into the skyline.
Oh, all the other buildings are just, like, mishmash, like, Tinker Toys around it.
It's the worst city planner. Someone was drunk when they laid out the grid for Chicago. Yeah, it's a disaster. So they're always facing the front of this building, presumably so you can recognize it and go, oh, that's where the parents are, whatever. So when Sarah's running from the mobsters, she sees the building facing her, once again, terribly composited, once again. It looks like there's a big black crayon line around it. And she goes running towards it because, oh, mom and dad will save me.
Yeah, sure.
When she sees that building, is she not miles and miles away from it? I mean, it is way the fuck out there.
So far away. They are far away from that building.
And then in the next scene, she's there. She's running into the building. She's not Thor. She's the Flash. She is there in like 10 seconds.
She's incredible.
I think the climax... I know you don't like the rafters sequence. For me, I think the climax is the weakest part of the film.
It's pretty terrible. Mm-hmm.
Every single part of this, I remember being so much cooler. Like, there's... because the other kids run out of the restaurant when they realize Sarah's missing, and then they see the building, and they're like, oh, she must have seen it and ran for it, because fucking sure.
Let's just go next door to that building, yeah.
So they all wind up in the building, and they all get up there no problem because security, fuck it. This is a city where you can just walk on stage at a blues club through the back door. And then it's split between Sarah on the set of Die Hard, where the floor that's under construction, with one of the mobsters chasing her up there, and then the rest of them on the floor where the dinner party with the parents is taking place. And it turns into a Three's Company episode where Chris puts on a fur coat and is trying to, like... dodge the parents, and it just feels so sitcom-y and terrible. And at this point, I really just wanted, it's time to get back to Oak Park. Let's Seriously. Wind this down. And for some reason, Sarah decides to crawl. Okay, so you have a problem with them going up on the rafters of, like, why would you do that? Why is crawling out of the fucking building the best solution?
This is a huge question for me, too. Why would you ever... Why?
There are so many props on that floor. There are so many things... that could have been done, and she just fucking climbs out. First of all, how'd she even get the... whatever.
It's terrible.
She's hanging outside the damn building.
I feel like those windows don't open. Like,
no!
You're not going to open a window that high up in any building in this city. In any city. That's ridiculous.
And even this is the silliest thing to nitpick. But like, the wind would blow this bitch right off the
building. She would never. As soon as she went out there, she'd have been off that building. She's got those little shoes with no tread on them at all.
And she's got the fucking Thor helmet with its wings. So I mean, she's like, she's really going for a ride. But I like that even the bad guy is just as stupid as like, well, obviously we're crawling outside out of the building now.
Get her, yeah.
And so, so he goes to get her. I guess he really, you know what, he does really need the Playboy though. And I'm being totally serious.
He does need it. Mm-hmm.
And it's so fucking mean too. It's so mean spirited that like, I have a big problem with the way this whole sequence wraps up too. Because so they escape the parents. They run up to and they pull Sarah back up and on a side note, when they're pulling her back through the window, when Brad grabs her and is pulling her through the window, she goes, "Oh, Brad." It's so weird and sexual. And this is not me being like, "Chris, you're too old for this movie. The bedpost isn't a wiener." This is like legit, like she wants to have sex with him.
Oh, I don't know. I didn't really get that. But yeah, she's a little.
I think she's very excited about what's just happened. She's not thinking straight.
She's kind of tuckered out. It's nearly midnight at this point in the movie. She's pretty young. So speed through all this stuff, out on the window, or out on the top of the building, for heaven's sakes.
She's ready to have sex with anything. She's ready. What you're saying.
She's ready. Even her brother. Super gross.
Okay, but no, so the reason I have a problem with it is not because she wants to hump a bro. It's because, do they really win here? Because the bad guy, the car thief, punches him and knocks him out, but then he throws the Playboy down on him like, oh, here, just take it. So the bad guy gets his magazine, and the car thief is presumably a dead man. Like, his days are now numbered for knocking this dude out.
Yeah, he's got to find a new job. Mm-hmm.
And they left the other guy out on the roof.
Yeah.
Just hanging there. And they laugh about it. They fucking laugh about it.
Like, let him think about it for a while.
Let him cool off.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they laugh. They laugh about...
It's murder. Like,
yes, it's murder.
Manslaughter, at least.
We're going to kill a guy. Then we're going to give the bad guy we've been running from exactly what he's after. And then we're going to go home because we are the worst protagonists in history.
That's about what...
So, and then you get your very predictable ending where she gets the kids home, the parents come in, and apparently they have no idea anything has taken place, so the worst babysitter ever gets away with it, which is fine, of course she does. Schmandrew shows up in the driveway to return one of Sarah's roller skates.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the kids watch from the window as, like, they're going to have their... first kiss, and then the song starts playing again, and that's Adventures in Babysitting. Wow. So in terms of looking at the movie as a big picture, a couple of things. I totally thought this was a John Hughes movie, that he had something to do with it. That I didn't think he directed it, but I thought he either wrote it or produced it or had something. I just remembered it as being one of the lesser John Hughes movies. I mean, it feels like that's kind of what they were aping. It's Chicago, Oak Park, witty teenagers. It seems like it was trying to fit in. But in retrospect, it makes sense that, first of all, I know we've been like shitting all over this movie and taking shots at it and everything. I didn't hate it, but it definitely does not have the same authenticity that a John Hughes movie has, even some of the more over-the-top ones. And so that makes sense to me that, like, I was a little relieved that, like, oh, okay, it wasn't a John Hughes movie.
Absolutely not. Yeah, I'm thrilled he did not have anything to do with it. It was, like you said, it's somebody just... It's one of those copycat instances. Somebody's trying to mimic him, and it was just... I love John Hughes, and this was no John Hughes production, I thought.
If it had been, it would have been the real Andrew McCarthy.
It would have been the real Andrew McCarthy, and it would have been better. It would have been less...
And Judd Nelson could have been shit Stickwell, or... Brad.
Mike Todwell.
Eat shit. Mike Todwell.
Yeah, Judd Nelson would have been good. You would have been like, oh man, I totally get why she's excited to go to a French restaurant with him. But no.
I have to say, though, I mean, there's certainly a lot to, like, make fun of and whatever, but one thing I think the movie actually does really well is I do like the setup and payoff of certain things. A lot of it used for jokes and whatever, but, like, even something like the license plate, which you see and you laugh at, like, that's so dumb, but it winds up becoming a plot point later. Like, I kind of like that stuff. And the chocolate on her fingers of, you know, because she's eating the desserts from the restaurant, and then when she runs from the bad guys, she's still got, like, a donut or something in her hand. And the way they know what floor she went to is that there's chocolate on two of the buttons.
True.
I know it's a small thing, but it was kind of like, all right, they put some thought into this at least. Like, I like that stuff. I do not like that Schmandrew basically solves all her problems for her, that she doesn't have to – she doesn't get them out of this situation.
Yeah.
I mean, she does in other ways, but for this main big last hurdle, it's basically because this dude wants to smush her privates with his, that's how they're going to get home. It's just because some guy thinks she's hot.
Yeah, I agree with you. I had a problem with the Schmander being this, like, deus ex machina that's all of a sudden comes in. And it feels a little hoary, too, because he's like, what can I do? And she's like, I need $50.
Like, yeah. Oh, I just want to see her be, like, smart, resourceful. Yeah. I want her to figure it out.
That's the opposite of what goes on with characters like little girl Sarah, who believes in Thor and thinks, well, I guess she also thinks that a superhero can save her. But yeah, a little girl who's like, oh yeah, we can do this, I'll be strong. And then this girl who just sort of seems to wait for life to happen to her, to wait for some jerk in a Camaro or some sweet guy with a Jeep to come along and take care of her. That's sort of, that is not the role model that I want ever. So I think Sarah's the coolest part of the movie, for sure.
She is, hands down. Sarah's the best, and Schmandrew needs to fuck off. I really don't like anything he's involved with in this film. It was just instantly kind of like a bummer for me. I still think Brad and Daryl are a little too old. I mean, I don't know if it's just because the actors look too close in age to her, like in real life, or I don't know. If Brad were younger, his crush wouldn't be as creepy to me. I know the idea is that it's that weird age where people still look at you like a kid, and that's sort of his whole arc. I don't know. It just felt like there would have been more at stake if it had been three kids, like legitimate kids that she's responsible for, not one kid and two guys who are pretty much in the same boat that she is.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I remembered it sort of more that way, that it would have been like three kids she was looking after. But they are, they're basically...
And I kept saying we were going to save this discussion of, like, reality versus fantasy for later. I mean, I think we got into it enough as we discussed the movie. I mean, it's just, the balance of legitimate threat and cartoon hijinks, it kind of sways back and forth too far in each direction. Like, it never really hits a sweet spot of, like, okay, I'm in, I believe in this world, and I also, like, I'm going to go with this. It's just constantly calling attention to itself where it's like, whoa, this feels a little too... intense, and then the next scene, this feels a little too cartoonish. Like these are not happening in the same world.
It's a weird,
like, the fucking street gangs, they belong on TGIF, where you know, like the special episode of Step by Step, where but then compared to something like The Chop Shop, and that scene belongs in, like, a Chuck Norris or Steven Seagal movie. It's even shot the same way. Like, the movie is very all over the place with its tone and its style. And I know it feels like the weirdest thing to criticize, like, for a movie that's aimed at children. I mean, to go back to something like The Goonies, the tone of that movie is so consistent. And, I mean, it lets you know early on this is the kind of world this story is taking place in. And you just, the more outlandish elements you just go with. Yeah. this movie is kind of like, hey, this is going to be real, and like, this is the big bad city. Ah, no, it's the cartoon version of the city. No, it's here's a blues club from Chicago. No, here now you're in the Warriors, and it's just back and forth, and it kind of it called a lot more attention to itself than I had remembered.
It's something that rewatching it, I would not before. I might have said to, you know, a younger person who'd never seen it, oh, you should watch it. Yeah, it's crazy. It's, I don't know, they get into all these crazy adventures. But now I would say, no, don't, skip it. Don't watch that. Watch Weird Science or watch The Goonies.
There's a million other movies from this era I would recommend before it. And even though it probably doesn't sound like it, I did not hate it. And I liked it more than I thought I would, because this felt like one of those. There's certain movies from your childhood you revisit and go, "Ooh, I should have left that door closed. I did not need to." Now it's just totally ruined. And I really thought, because I think I've seen bits and pieces of it on TV or other places throughout the years, and I had this feeling like this is going to be a bad movie. This is going to ruin this movie forever for me. I will say that, like, if you have never seen it before, I mean, there's no reason to. If there's so many better movies, but I think you'd watch it. Even the stuff that stuck out to us, I think, would really stick out to people that had never seen it, and especially if you're not in our age group. Like, if you didn't grow up with these kinds of movies, like if I weren't a child of the late '80s, early '90s, this would be a huge, like, the fuck am I watching? But even with all the seams showing and all of that, it was still extremely nostalgic for me. I thought even some of the stuff that seemed really dated was kind of charming and fun. And so I don't know. I'm kind of torn on it. I didn't dislike it as much as you did, but it was... yeesh. It didn't hold up as well as... I don't know. I do have some fun trivia about the movie,
okay,
though. I did. That was
sorry.
That was so confident. Donna, are you sitting down? Because we're about to have some fun. Buckle up. That was so stupid. I'm just on autopilot. I'm gonna say that every episode now. Donna, I've got some fun trivia. That was so stupid.
Okay.
All right. Okay, guys. Okay, so the guy that directed this, Chris Columbus, also he wrote Gremlins and The Goonies. He also, what else? He went on to direct the Home Alone movies, Mrs. Doubtfire, the first two Harry Potters, tons of stuff. This guy is like one of the go-to guys if you're going to make like a movie for kids in this sort of age range. That's kind of what his whole career has sort of been built on. And he's been involved with great, great movies. So I guess a lot of this, I don't know, for a first-time director, I mean, for his first movie, there are definitely seeds here of the stuff he would go on to do later, especially, I think, the Home Alone movies.
Absolutely, yeah.
Did this look like Chicago to you?
Sort of.
I am going to admit that as they were driving into the city, I thought, oh, right on. These are like legitimate locations. Like, I knew they were probably going to fudge the layout of the city a little bit. Like, we might be jumping from, like, the Loop to the South Side to, you know, to whatever.
Wrigley,
like,
and, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. You know what? Surprisingly, it did avoid that, though. Like, let's hit all the major landmarks.
Yes, it did.
Like, all the things, you know, it's not a tour of Chicago. But the reason for that might be because most of it was filmed in Toronto. They were not near any of these Chicago landmarks.
Ah, our super clean sister city.
And that's probably why the, you know, the building that the parents are in looks so shitty, the way it's been inserted into all these shots it doesn't belong in, because that's not the Chicago skyline. They weren't near that building.
I see.
And then when the one shot where they try to put in the Sears Tower, like where everything all the buildings you know about Chicago are all crammed right next to each other.
Yeah.
And they're just all sort of like haphazardly arranged there. So it's, I guess, because they couldn't actually get a shot of
It is elusive, this crazy city. You can hardly get a picture, yeah.
I'm sure it was much cheaper to to shoot in Toronto.
No, course, yeah.
This was the first... Peach, I'm not done with my fun trivia, so I hope... I hope I haven't... I hope you're... I hope I haven't worn you out yet. Nope. This is the first PG-13 film released by a Disney film division, which I think it was Touchstone. Ooh. And it was... for some reason, retitled A Night on the Town for its UK release.
Mm.
I think it's since come out on DVD over there under its real name, but for a long time, that's kind of how it was known overseas, was as A Night on the Town. What have I got here? They shot a pilot for a TV series version of Adventures in Babysitting in 1989 with, yeah, and this is the part I think you're going to like, Joey Lawrence as Brad.
Whoa. Oh, wow.
And Brian Austin Green as Daryl.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
They didn't pick it up. It didn't go to series. They just shot the pilot and the network said, pass.
Oh, wow. We gotta...
And then of course, I'm sure, I don't know if you've heard this, but for years and years, there's been rumors of a remake of the movie. Oh. At one point, Raven Simone was attached to star in it.
Oh,
and I seem to remember at one point it was going to be called Further Adventures in Babysitting. So it was kind of like, well, is it a remake then? Or is it like a sequel, a spiritual sequel? I don't know what's going on there. I think more recently, Miley Cyrus, her name came up.
Oh, my God.
But anyway, I mean, the project is still kicking around. They're still... I don't know if we're ever going to see it at any point. Did you happen to see the Jonah Hill movie, The Sitter?
No.
Because it is basically an R-rated version of this movie.
Oh, there you go.
Only it is with, it's kind of what we talked about, where the kids are all, they're legitimately like little kids.
Yeah.
And it's Jonah Hill in the Elizabeth Shue role.
Yeah, yeah.
It is not a good movie, but you have to watch it. For Sam Rockwell is the bad guy in it.
Oh, he's such a good bad guy.
He is amazing. He's great in everything he does. Even when everything around him is total garbage, he's still great. And he is great in the movie. And the what the fuck factor of his first scene is worth the whole movie.
Oh.
You have to watch it just for the when Jonah Hill meets him and is like kind of led into this lair of his. It is like... it's amazing. I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah, it's going on my queue right now. I'm putting it on.
Okay, guys, that's it. Thanks for listening to the first episode of Hey, Do You Remember? Please let us know if you have any suggestions for other movies we should revisit at some point, and we'll see you next time.